The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Welcome, everyone, to the latest installment of the podcast series brought to you by the North American Spine Society, where we highlight articles from the Spineline publication. My name is Alex Michael. I'm the chair of the Public Affairs Committee with NASS. I'm a practicing neurosurgeon out of St. Louis, Missouri. And I'm very fortunate to have with me Jacob Razouk and Dr. Denisa from the Loma Linda University School of Medicine. And they're going to share their paper entitled Artificial Intelligence and Spine Care, What You Need to Know. Thank you both so much for being with us today. How about we just start with sharing some background information about you guys to some of our listeners. Tell us how you got involved with AI and spine care. Dr. Denisa, why don't we go to you?
Okay, thank you, Michael. So I'm Olamide Denisa, and I'm orthopedic spine surgeon. I am chief of spine surgery here at Loma Linda University. I'm also the vice chair and endowed professor for orthopedic research. I'm also actually in conjunct adjunct faculty also at the Department of Neurosurgery here at Loma Linda. My interest in obviously in or spine surgery and spine care is not just in the clinical, but also when we talk about the research. And for me, it's part and parcel of my practice. And I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing now in our society, not just even in medicine, but throughout American society and the world society, is the use of artificial intelligence globally, and then what we use in research with machine learning. So I think that's really an explosion, really, in our world right now, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, it's just such a timely article for today, because you can't open up the news without hearing talk about ChatGPT and AI just revolution, different professions, different fields as a whole, and what kind of jobs it's going to get rid of and replace. And yeah, this paper was just incredibly timely. Jacob, you are a medical student, you were saying, at Loma Linda.
Yes, sir. I'm a second year medical student at Loma Linda University, and I'm just beyond fortunate to have had the mentorship of Dr. Denisa, who pretty much single-handedly has inspired the rest of my career to pursue spine surgery. And, you know, I got into AI and machine learning really out of my own insecurity and just frustration, because you hear all this stuff out there, and it's funny how now you can't go look at any news outlet without hearing about AI. And with this explosion of knowledge, there's almost been an increase in confusion as a result of all the kind of noise that's out there about it. So I really got into it and took a deep dive, because I just wanted to know. And I kind of saw this as something that's here to stay and something that needs to be embraced, because right now we're only in the early days. So you know, when Graham Bell invented the telephone, what iPhone 20 or whatever we're on now looks like, it is very different. So being able to start, you know, at sort of its inception, or right when it's now hitting this inflection point where it's actually going to start impacting our lives, I think now is definitely the time to, you know, learn it just as any other subject we need to know in medicine.
Agreed. Yeah, it's a very exciting time for medicine. And you know, to the first paragraph, you guys just jump right in and talk about medical imaging. And I remember being in your shoes too, and just trying to figure out what profession I'd want to go into. And I thought neurosurgery, orthospine surgery had a lot of job security, or really any surgery profession I thought had a lot of job security, because I thought being replaced by machines or some kind of artificial intelligence was going to be so far off for something technical. But when I looked at the like road professions, like radiology, that's the one that did kind of concern me a bit, because that seemed like the easiest and quickest to be replaced. It still might not be in our lifetime. But I think you guys do a good job of portraying what really could happen. And we're already seeing software to that effect. So do you want to tell us a little bit about the automated analysis medical imaging that you guys described?
Well, one of the earliest things in medical imaging has been with looking in, especially in AIs, basically teaching the machine or the computer to read x-rays. And one of the biggest things, if you're looking at breast radiographs and looking for people who have potentially breast cancer. And, you know, the iterations actually in radiology is one of the first to really embrace this. And they've gotten the first ideations of this was like teaching the machine to look at a numerous number. And it actually, as it learns, what is pathologic. And basically, at least now, in diagnostic radiology, it's called a computer-assisted diagnosis, where the machine can actually be on par. I think what the reasonable has been like to be at a level as a third or fourth year radiology resident, and in accuracy, probably not to the level of a true fellowship-trained breast imaging expert, but still good enough. And so, in the sense that it can do a lot of weeding out, and I suspect the issue there is to see what are the false negatives and or the false positives, and see how you can really drill that down to see how effective this can be in, as a screening tool. So I think initially screening is the thing, and then once there is a red flag, then we can actually have a human assist in that. But yes, that has really taken away a lot of the issues with when we talk about fatigue and mm-hmm. being able to see a lot of data. And that can help us with the imaging. And I mean, we even have, when we talked about, not just even in imaging, there, you know, there was, we used, and I think in Stanford, they used something called a smart ICU. And, you know, I actually gave a talk on what we call the California Orthopedic Association, where they, in Stanford, they have a smart ICU using sensors and wearable technology, whereby real time, it can actually give the staff an idea when someone is in sepsis and actually in real time treat it rather than just waiting for other things, not just, you know, temperature going up or the blood pressure. This actually real time teaches us how to do that. So there are many iterations of machine learning or even AI in helping us with that. And as you said, with radiology too.
Yeah, and each one of these facets, that's what I kept thinking, is how can it scan through big data, help with the fatigue? And that's the biggest concern, I think, for all of us, is how do we prevent burnout and all these normal scans? But I was like trying to think of things that routinely get missed, even by trained radiologists, far lateral discs, those like accessory facets, the Bertolotti syndromes and stuff like that, that is this black box of just back pain. And sometimes if we're, you know, going fast throughout the day, seeing 15 patients in clinic, things get missed, you know, what could that help with? So I don't know where we're at with, you know, that specific data set, or if it's more, you know, finding those bread and butter herniated paracentral discs or whatnot. But that's what I envisioned the future to be holding for the automated spine care for lumbar imaging. But how about the predictive modeling? Because that's very similar, going through very large amounts of information so we can really focus on these technical aspects of surgery. You guys talked about predictive modeling, identifying who's at high risk for surgery, high risk for needing rehabilitation. This is something I've tried to do in my own practice, just printed out algorithms. You guys might know a little bit more too, because I think a lot of it comes from total knee literature, total joints, on who's at high risk to be discharged to rehab after an elective surgery. We've tried to do that already and preempt it, get these people in with physical therapy beforehand, get them in with the social worker before surgery, try to expedite their care, so they don't waste days and days of time trying to get pre-authorization to go to rehab if we can know beforehand that they're already going to be a candidate. I thought that would be a huge time-saving effort and financial-saving effort just by days saved of hospital care.
Yes, and what... Oh, go ahead, Dr. Nisa.
No, Jacob, you go ahead.
No, so, you know, we talk about in the article, we describe it as this sort of crystal ball, right? Where one of the huge advantages now with artificial intelligence is, you know, now, whereas in the past, we had to apply statistics such as regression onto data to develop these risk calculators and whatnot. So we had to do it prospectively and fit the data to the our modeling. Whereas now what artificial intelligence brings to the table is it can analyze the data at the beginning and then create a model around the data rather than imposing a model to try to describe the data. So by doing so, it's able to identify more complex and nuanced relationships and reflect those nuances in a better way to develop more accurate modeling. You know, one of the co-authors on this, Dr. Ramos, he was talking about how, you know, it's very likely in the future how we're going to have all the patient's info in the electronic medical record synchronized with these modeling capabilities to in real time give you statistics on, okay, here is their percentage risk for this complication, and really changing the game. There's a developing data set by Epic called Epic Cosmos that is now integrating data from several institutions that is really never before seen. So now instead of having isolated pools of patients and or even in the multi-institutional studies, the prospects offered by data sets such as Epic Cosmos is never before seen. Whereas even in good studies, you're talking maybe hundreds of patients. Whereas with Epic Cosmos, now the denominator is going to be in the thousands and just totally change what the bar is in setting a new standard.
Which is actually, you know, what Jacob's saying is absolutely true. So one of the things that when you talk about multivariate analysis, you know, you're trying to figure out, you have a lot of variables and then trying to look at those variables and how they interact. So when you use a machine or a computer, in contrast to humans, the machine can tell the difference between linear and nonlinear relationships. And that's one of the things there. Sometimes we don't even realize what is a specific or important decision tree is that term. The computer does a much better job than we do. When you do that, then you may find some variables that you didn't think of. So like what Jake was talking about, discharge. So one of the early papers written has been like discharge destination, such as, are they going to go home? Are they going to go to rehab? Which is all very cogent data for what we need to do as clinicians when we operate, and especially now. And I think one of the things that helps us is it helps us, but also helps the insurance companies. I don't know if that's information that can be used against us. It's, again, it's information. Now, can it tell you when someone's going to have a complication? You have a dural leak. Have an infection? Not necessarily, but you may be able to predict and look at that and see what kind of factors in that patient. And some of these issues that we're looking at now and some of the papers we're writing have been, what does not just the typical BMI or other anthropometric variables, what if the person is single or married, or, you know, what kind of insurance they have? How predictive is it for sending them home? Well, how predictive is it for, I mean, if you have an operation, like, for example, if we have someone who's having a deformity surgery, what is the risk factor for a patient with a 5 or more level surgery requiring blood transfusion? What is the risk factor for neurologic injury? So this is a predict. It's not perfect, just like when we use technology and data, but it does give us a somewhat of a template and to also to predict how well we're doing. It tells us how well we're doing as a whole. And, you know, when you use the data, now we're having access to big data. And so when you have in the past, when you have randomized prospective studies, we're talking a good study is a couple hundred people. As Jacob has said, now we're talking about thousands. And hopefully we can kind of hopefully weed out some of the biases, because we worry about biases we're trying to devise studies. And, you know, we try to do clinical studies without computers too. And we see we have much less numbers. The machine or the computer kind of says it. Now, the problem is, and the limiting factor is the data. How good is the data? In the past, we've used data, as Jacob has said, we've used, like, for example, NISWIP data. NISWIP data from the American College of Surgeons gives you data for only about 30 to 90 days, you know, from admission. We need something a little bit longer. And some exciting things that we're talking about now, especially in spine surgery, as you've talked about, you know, what do we do about people who are going to go home? What do we do with people who are going to go outpatient surgery? And really, we're really excited about that, to prognosticate what are the factors that, you know, will allow us to say, hey, you're going to go to, going to be able to go home. Even things that we've written papers on opiate demands on patients. And what is what are the risk factors for that? So it's very exciting. And rather than actually going into the chart and tabulating, requiring a lot of, you know, people, the computer can do it and maybe do a better job, obviously.
How easy do you think it is for an independent software designer to create something that integrates with Epic? You know, is Epic monopolizing their own EHR, and do they have control of who can use their own data? You know, that's one of the things I thought of toward the end of the article, actually, on we have all the information within a chart for a single patient. How do we extract it, and who can extract it?
You know, when we work with Epic Cosmos, it's very collaborative in nature. You know, you can actually, right now, Epic Cosmos, it's very new, and they're still adding data by the day, by the hour. But right now, it's very collaborative in nature. And that's actually something I wanted to touch on, was because after reading, when you get to the end of the article, probably one of the most pressing questions one would have is, okay, so how do you get involved, right? Like, how do you begin to take advantage of this stuff? Because right now, it sounds like there's a barrier to entry where you might understand the principles, but to make that connection, there's a disconnect there. And so one of the things we want to highlight for the listeners today is, after reading the article, the article provides a lot of the mechanics, right? The terms, the definitions, the groundwork that you need to be competent. And even reading that, some of the listeners might be like, wow, there's a lot of strange terms. When we were talking about the image segmentation, some of them aren't even terms. They're just a string of letters. And I remember when I was first learning, it was very kind of intimidating, or it felt just like a new language. And I think that's something that is a common feeling. And I think a key thing to for everyone to understand is, a lot of these terms, we talk about one of the algorithms, random forest. The name just, it sounds random. It doesn't describe what it's talking about. And I think that's something that listeners have to kind of get over when they're first learning about all these terms. For instance, Python, which is one of the most common languages, the name comes from, the inventor named it after a BBC television comedy series back in the 1970s called Monty Python's Flying Circus. And so, you know, there's just these random terms, whereas in medicine, you know, we're used to the word being some Latin derivative that it makes sense, right? Whereas now with AI, there's a lot of stuff that the word doesn't give you any intuition as to what it's talking about. But once you understand the mechanics, and I'm going on a bit of a tangent here, but it all comes together, is once you understand those underlying mechanics, the question you asked, Dr. Michael, like, how do you, you know, what are the implications? How do you get involved? And really, I think the surprising main point I want to make in today's podcast is actually talking about networking and teamwork, because I think those two, well, I guess you could argue it's one thing, but being able to network, because AI is a very, it is complicated, and it's going to require teamwork from policymakers, from the back end people making the actual software. So as you said, Dr. Michael, you know, you can be an independent developer, but that's that. As we continue to escalate, it's going to require a teamwork from clinicians and policymakers alike, because we as clinicians are not, we can't be, maybe there are a few polyglots, but we can't be experts in medicine and on the cutting edge of AI at the same time. So really develop, breaking down those communication barriers where we can collaborate is going to be just so key.
A little word, another word you're talking about when you said about Epic. Epic does have an advantage over other projects. You know, in the Journal of American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, it talks about electronic medical records. Epic right now does have a big head start. A lot of, I can tell you, academic centers use Epic. A lot of, I mean, our center here uses Epic very similarly. And so, can we collaborate and talk about it? There are other EHRs or EMRs that people call, and there's different, but Epic does have a huge slice of that pie. Now, a lot of the research that we talk about, whether it's neurosurgery or orthopedic surgery or just spine surgery, whether it's NAS, whether it's terms like the AO study group or the ISSG, they have, it's still, or SRS, when you look at the studies, and the, those are very exclusive to the members, right? Unlike that, if you have someone like Epic, you don't have to be part of those things and still have access to a lot of data. There, the Spine Registry has that, but Spine Registry has some limitations. So now that we have it, we're getting a little bit better about getting the data. I think it might be easier to do research, especially clinical research. But the issues are, for us as clinicians, we may not have the know-how where software engineers and computer programmers have that head start. And it's a little bit more, at least in their world, conducive for collaboration, which ours was a little bit more esoteric and sometimes exclusive.
Yeah, no, well put. That's a great point. They, to continue building their brand and keeping themselves at the top, they're incentivized to continue to be collaborative and make it extremely user-friendly and patient-centric. So you're absolutely right.
Yes, and just to add one more, you know, the listener are probably like, collaborative, but that's very vague, you know, kind of doesn't even answer the question. But what we mean when, you know, right now, when you go on to the Epic Cosmos, you can call a number and you can be in touch with an Epic representative within minutes, and they will help you if you have questions, because they are also interested in solving the same problems you are. So right now it's very, the channel of communication is very open.
I want to talk a little bit about implant design, which we're seeing on market, groups like Medtronic. I'm sure a lot of other independent device companies are doing individualized implant designs, rods, cages, 3D printed equipment. Any barriers that you foresee that we still need to overcome? Any current deficits? I think one of the biggest benefits that I see with groups like Medtronic is their pre-planning software, which is good for sagittal deformity, sagittal correction, not great for coronal balance as of now, but I remember the first long segment fusion I did with a 3D printed rod. And unless you get the screws exactly where you say you're going to get the screws, it doesn't always line up. You still had to cut the rod, still had to bend the rod a bit. So it was imperfect. I'm sure if you put it in using the robot and have everything pre-planned exactly where you want it and put exactly where you pre-planned it, then everything might fit a little bit better. But there's always small nuances they can't account for. You know, 2 degrees here or there ends up being 10 degrees in the long run. So had do you foresee any new additions in the near future or new barriers, bumps in the road that we need to continue to work on?
I think what you just said about the implant design is very important, because before, at least the majority of the implants that we use, it's kind of like one size fits all. We know that's not the case, especially when we're doing things like deformity surgery. As you said, you know, like with Medtronic, and you know, when you, all the little platforms where they have at least derivations of things like such like a SurgiMap, NuvaMap, and all these things where you can plan and make it just very boutique. And you know, and it's not necessarily to use a certain name. There are companies out there that said, yes, send us the patient's CT, send the MRI, and then we can, the biggest limiting factor to that right now is really cost. Because if you have that and make it specific to that patient, which is great, as you know, we are still limited. I mean, it's kind of like when we go to WNS or CNS or the NAS meeting, and we see the behind the scenes look at the newest, greatest robot. I mean, I was just at CNS and I, you know, looked at a robot, and you could basically stand on it and it would not move. It'll stop where it gets close to the, I mean, you're like, oh my God. I mean, remember, it wasn't that long ago when they had the Da Vinci, and the Da Vinci was, wow, it was great for GU and, you know, and urology. And then, but for us, we're like, what does that do? Well, we've seen this explosion with all these robots, and you're like, okay, I can put in like 30 screws and you don't have the fatigue, and you put it in with a drill. I mean, that for me, at my age, thinking about when I started, we were putting in pedicle screws by Landmark and taking a plain film, from plain film to fluoro to fluoronav to, you know, O-arm to now we've got all these, you know, intraoperative CTs. So, you know, then you get exposure and lack of or no exposure for at least the surgical team. But still, with innovation, and you're still dealing with marketing and free enterprise, companies don't do it just necessarily for the goodness of their heart. They're making any new implant, whether it's even titanium, the modulus, they increase the price, and then we still have to deal with dollars and cents with the hospital, whether it's an academic hospital or community hospital, or, you know, what about, like, for example, a VA system, where VA systems, they don't cut deals. So they pay list prices for things that can be very exorbitant. I have just recently, I do quite a bit of tumor work, and I've been trying to use, and the new thing with tumor is been using carbon fiber implants. And if you know the difference between carbon fiber and titanium, I want to use carbon fiber where the cage is, where you can follow the patient with CT or MRI or PET scan. And even the radiation oncologists love that if you don't have the metal scatter. Even when you use like the MARS for metal artifact reduction system, when you use carbon fiber, each carbon fiber screw is about $4,000. Most hospitals shudder at that when they see just for a screw. They're like, oh my God, I have to like write almost like an essay every time when I want to try to use one of those.
Yeah, good point. That and BMP. I think both of those have decreased costs over the next 5 years or so. But yeah, great point. To go along with the AI guided navigation, I was really interested to hear about the idea of feedback, intraoperative feedback. That obviously seems like the next logical safety mechanism when we're using navigation, because yeah, you can put the screw anywhere you want based off of the interop CT, but should you put it there? You know, how deep should you put it? That seems like such a logical thing that I can't believe they haven't already integrated into the Stealth Machine or Brain Lab or whatever you're using for intraoperative navigation. Anything else that you guys saw on the forefront for AI with surgical navigation?
Well, just as I was telling you, I just saw, as I said, at the CNS meeting, behind the scenes, and there was a feedback factor, and I'm not going to name the company, but there was a feedback factor where you try to put the screw and it won't let you do it. And it would just, so
oh, it just won't let you do it.
Yeah, it just won't let you do it. It's okay. Stop. And then you can actually navigate it so much so that, for example, you're looking at the cord, you can set it to say, I don't want it to get within 2 millimeters of the cord or the nerve root. And it's amazing. And then you said, so then, you know, and it's even, I was wondering, well, how well does it do for poor bone quality? For example, I just did a case today. And, you know, that's why, you know, with someone with tremendously poor bone quality, we measured the Hounsfield units on CT. It's poor. They had this, you know, a patient who had a fracture and then developed like a 70 degree kyphotic deformity. But then, you know, not only did I have to put hardware on this person, which is a little crazy, which I would never have done before, do hardware and then use cement augmentation. And I'm telling you, so... And not only that, I was able to use the CT and find, looking at the CT, I can look at it and say where the best bone is, not just right down the middle of the pedicle. I can angle it to say, hey, where is the best bone for this? And then target it and then still use cement augmentation for that and then base it off and try to use some form of correction techniques with using interbody. So we are integrating it now. I'm doing that real time. And I'm not, and I'm sure lots of people, it's not like I'm so unique, but you can actually look at it and go, okay, so I actually have to do certain steps myself, not necessarily the computer, but I know where the best bone is to put the screws.
You know, it's really reassuring about the future, but I guess at the same time, kind of worrisome that we could have all the experience for all a generation's worth of trained surgeons, and hearing exactly what you said is invaluable and can take, you know, a lifetime to understand. And a computer could tell us that. It could tell us, let's just put the screw here, you'll get better outcomes, but you don't really understand why. When I was in training too, I worked with a lot of orthopedic spine surgeons that were still doing biplanar fluoro for their MIS or even single shot fluoro and just using anatomy. We did them for pediatric scoliosis cases. I only worked with a couple that use navigation, and navigation was kind of mocked a bit by the non-users. And they said, if you only use navigation, you're never going to understand. What if the navigation fails? What if the arm breaks down? Are you going to cancel a day's worth of surgery if you're not familiar with doing it the old-fashioned way? And I think we're all kind of worried about that too, is if a computer's just telling us what we should be doing, where we should be putting screws without really understanding why we're doing it that way. You know, does that limit us as a profession? You know, maybe it will lead to better patient outcomes, but we get lucky every once in a while and patients do well. And then when they don't do well, how do we salvage that? So I don't know. These are all kind of things that I'm thinking of as we've just been talking to. I always been teaching the fundamentals before going forward, but it had me think about another part of the paper too, about the virtual reality and the surgical simulation and how tremendous that would be impactful for surgical teaching of residents, perhaps maybe even decreasing the time of surgical training. Sometimes the duration of time is necessary just to see these kind of rare pathologies and go through the motions to graduate, you know, levels of involvement in the surgery from assistant to a more senior involvement to doing the whole surgery yourself. You know, what if you do the entire thing 20 times before you step into the OR? You know, what if it's that realistic of feedback that the first time you close a durotomy is really like your 50th time, you know?
Well, so, I think when you were talking about that, there is still the issue with the unique thing with surgery is not only do you have to have the information, but also you have to have the technical know-how. And obviously each person is a little different. There's some people who are just gifted, and then there's some people who have to learn. And it depends. Each one of us has a learning curve. Just like you said, you know, one of the things I think the more mature surgeon is, so, hey, I know where this is supposed to be and looking at the anatomy. But, you know, for example, minimally invasive surgery is a big deal now. When I open something into a big operation, I kind of know the anatomy. Even if the computer or the robot tells me, hey, I just say, it just doesn't look right, doesn't feel right. You know that. So yeah, there have been times where I've done a case or done cases where the navigation is not right and I check it. And I always have fluoro in the room too. I said, yep, and I've tried it and it's off just a little bit. And then I'm sure you've seen if you use the robot, when you take, you look at your, you know, you put it things in, you look at your fiducials, you check your accuracy over and over again. Do things move just a little bit and you recheck it rather than just completely putting, because we've all heard of stories where people, especially in deformity, where you put it in, put screws and you do like cement and all of a sudden the screws are the wrong in the place where it's not, until you are good at knowing it feels right. And that's from countless times. You know, simulation is great. We have kind of a limitation with, for example, we teach our residents in, you know, people may not like that. We teach residents while in real time with patients, but also we deal with cadavers. Sawbones is not the same feel, but we also, but cadavers are expensive. I mean, so even when you do like a lumbar cadaver, a torso, that's like $2,000-$3,000 per cadaver. There's a limitation how much we can do. We do partner with some of the implant companies, and when we get those cadavers and get the trucks in, I really take advantage of teaching the residents and the fellows about that, because that's invariable experience, and then you can make a mistake and it's, no one gets really hurt.
It skipped over something I wanted to ask you guys a little bit about too, is that, and that's more like intelligent monitoring within the OR. A little bit about electrophysiology monitoring and real-time feedback, you know, being trained on alarm criteria and how that would integrate into the OR to really treat any kind of alarm criteria by supplementing blood pressure, for example.
Well, clinically, I think that, at least in my experience, when we have something, there's a change. I've never been really that happy with even intraoperative neuromonitoring, because usually the monitoring tech doesn't tell me when something happens. It's usually like 5-10 minutes and they say, hey, there's been a change. And I said, well, how long has that been? Oh, about 15 minutes ago. And I said, well, why haven't you told me earlier? Things like, well, check, you know, just the in deformity cases, whether it's pediatric, you have that list of things, your checklist of things to, well, yeah, what's the, make sure the leads are in, what's the blood pressure, yeah, how much blood, you know, things like that. Those are all the things that we have. And rather than trying to think of that when the stress is there, you have it in the check right in the room, say, how about this, how about, but sometimes the monitoring tech is, they see a problem and then they try to troubleshoot. So they don't even know. They troubleshoot first, and then they talk to maybe the attending neurologist, and they try to troubleshoot. So by the time we get to it, it's very stressful. You're so focused on what you're doing, and then when you find out, it's like, oh my gosh. So
that's so funny. I've had the exact same experience. You're absolutely right. It's like they do try to troubleshoot first. They make sure all the leads are intact still. They talk to anesthesia. You kind of hear some rumblings behind the screens, and all of a sudden they're not in their chair, you know, and it's like, where are we within this? And what is this? Is the criteria for you to alert me the same as I would want it? You know, is it a 50% drop? But that's probably the next level, is how do we incorporate that with all these other facets of care? The anesthesiologists are completely separate. How do we integrate that with giving them the appropriate medication, increase their blood pressure, for example, or checking their last electrolytes? How does it integrate with the Epic information that they could just draw from and give us, you know, the last lab values, the last maps, all that other information? That's, I think, the real challenge that I keep coming back to, is integration with all the other healthcare facets, because Medtronic can make a great robot, you know, they can make a great implant, but if it doesn't pair up with all the other things that we use within the OR, then there's going to be a barrier at some point.
Right. Well, just like you said, with technology, it has to be integrated. And there are a lot of people that are, I mean, for what you're talking about, intraoperative neurophysiologists with anesthesia, and exactly what are, you know, I think that would be a great study. And actually, we are actually working on a study looking back on people who have had issues with not just necessarily neurologic deficits, but changes in the neuromonitoring, whether it's the motor vocal potential somatization. What is the criteria? As you said, is it 50% diminution? And, you know, what is it? And with, you know, with the blood pressure at the time and trying to, the problem with that has been, at least for me, in trying to get that data to say, how do we integrate? When does that happen? When, so what have we done now is like in the operating room, we have all these monitors. And so we can see what the blood pressure is at the time. How often does anesthesia do get blood gases to see what is, you know, the PO2, what's the hematocrit or hemoglobin? And you know, sometimes there is almost like a 10-15% difference in what the hemoglobin is intra-op in an A line versus a true blood draw. So we've got to be able to do better about trying to, because, you know, what is the term? I think Mike Phelan says time is neurologic deficit. You know, basically with spine surgery, time is it, when is it become irreversible? When is it something that we can change? Is it during, is it during a reduction maneuver? Is it during, you know, for example, when we do derotation, when we do, when we expand, when we do a PSO or something, and how much do you stretch something out, and when do we stop? And then what do you do when you stop? I mean, it's kind of neuromonitoring. There are people who use neuromonitoring for everything. For example, for me, neuromonitoring does really no good for me when I'm doing like a decompression, like laminectomy. When you take the bone out, I can't put it back in. But when you're doing a correction, something that changes the anatomy a little bit, then you want to know right away to either stop it or if you can reverse it.
Yeah. And I thought the same. That's why I stopped using it for single two-level ACDF for myelopathy. You know, maybe if it's 3-4 level big deformity correction of some sort, maybe that has a role. But for something like that, once there is an alarm criteria, something has happened and it's too late.
Right.
Yeah, there's not a gross manipulation of the spine. Posterior cervical, I'm using it still pretty routinely for that, you know, regardless of trauma or not. But the biggest take home that I have seen is I look at the analogy of like the self-checkout at the supermarket. We might need fewer of some of the adjunct healthcare professionals, some of the spine care professionals, but they probably would have a repurposing. They'd have this new skill set to be able to better understand the computer integration and AI, better adept at troubleshooting it, and maybe looking at more data sets. So you still have to have a really firm understanding of what you're doing as a practitioner, but you have to develop this new skill set too. So everything that we've talked about, starting at diagnosis, coming up with preferred medical management, failing that, then preferred surgical management, coming up with what specific type of surgical management with implant design, intraoperative selection, intraoperative feedback, and then complication profile. All this is just fascinating things. It's almost impossible to research everything, but this is a great overview. What's in the future for you guys? If you gravitated toward one or a few of these particular topics in more detail, or am I missing anything on the horizon here?
Well, I don't know. I'll let Jacob say a few things. So some of the things that I've been looking at, we've looked at things, and I look at it in phases or little pockets. For example, we have now started doing things such as, for example, something as simple as the term foraminal stenosis. We talk about it all the time in surgery, and we know that foraminal stenosis is there, whether it's cervical or lumbar, for example. And there's a lot of data on what central stenosis is, but how much data is there on congenital stenosis? But foraminal, so many people have done surgeries on that. And I can tell you, I have, for example, one of the reasons why I thought about it was I'm an oral examiner for the boards. And I see some people bring up an x-ray and they say, well, this person has foraminal stenosis. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, well, where is it? You know, or exactly. And they said, well, of course, we all know foraminal stenosis is twofold, for example. One, the clinical, but then what is the radiographic? So we started and we started looking at it. So one of the things that Jacob has done, we did a study looking at what we said normative values for foraminal. So we took a set of 1,000. So what a task. 1,000 people, for example, x-rays, and we looked at and measured the foramen in the lumbar from L1 to S1 and from the cervical from C2 to T1 and looked at the foramen and looked at the dimensions, not just the AP, top to bottom, the width, and then we used a tool for the area. So from that, we were able to say, this is a normative value, and we had not just a, so normally we had people who looked at stenosis and said, this is what it kind of looks like. I can see on the MRI the loss of the fat versus the confine. It just looks pinched. But those are descriptive terms. What is the quantitative term? Well, we did that. And that's one of the papers we presented at CNS. We did it for the cervical. We did it for the lumbar. That's our baseline for what it, now we're going to phase 2 and phase 3 and saying, hey, compare those to people who have symptoms, okay? Well, guess what? If you can teach a computer, say, this is what the normal is, plus or minus deviation. What is the threshold? The computer, I mean, heck, the computer can tell you on MRI or CT, this person has foraminal stenosis by radiographic diet. So it can measure it for you and the radiologist, and then we ourselves can do it. Rather than that's one thing. So we're talking about anatomic data, okay? So then we talk about clinical data. And so what are the things that matter to us and the pressures with insurance companies is, well, can you do the surgery and how long do you think it should take to do it? Now, hopefully that's not going to be data used against us because data can be good or can be bad. It's just data, right? Am I a good surgeon if I can get someone out from like a 3-level fusion, if I can get them out in a day, 2 days or 3 days? So things have changed. I remember when I was in fellowship, we were doing ACDFs and they were in ICU overnight. That seems that's strange. Now we send people home. So it has changed in my lifetime, in my career. So, but I want to continue. When, as I said now, so that's another thing, clinical data. How much better can I be? How much better, how can I prognosticate what I do for my patients? And and you take the same surgeon and different patients, but you take all that data, how does that help? Next, we're looking at, complications. What complications can we see or predict someone can have? The possibilities are just endless. There's so many papers. And in fact, we were talking about neurosurgery. The journal had a big thing just recently, I think just this month, on AI. And it was a very well-written paper also. It is coming out with clinical looking and also with implants and making us better surgeons. So we have, we're talking about with clinical stuff, with anatomic stuff. So I think it is not something that's going to go away anywhere. It's our reality. It's no longer science fiction. It's no longer like the movies like The Matrix or The Terminator. It's here. And, when we're talking about it, I just saw there was a thing on Yahoo. I saw my child had seen 7 different specialists, but ChatGPT diagnosed their problem. I was like, oh my God, here we go.
3.0 or 4.0? It must have been the 4.0.
I guess it must be.
Yes, exciting stuff. Thank you guys for the commitment you have and looking into this. Thank you for the time this evening to discuss it with us. I think we're reaching an hour of time.
Okay, wonderful.
So if you want any last words, please feel free. Otherwise, thank you for all your time and keep up the good work.
Thank you. I have nothing. Jacob, if you have something, go ahead.
No, thank you so much for having us. I think Dr. Denisa covered it very well. I think the emphasis is really going to be ensuring we have high quality data. So that cross collaboration we were talking about with computer engineers and really the people at the forefront of their field, if we can bridge the communication gap between our field and theirs, then we can really make headway in terms of producing, you know, there's that term garbage in, garbage out, where if you're not applying the you can apply all the methodology you want, if the intrinsic value of the data is not there, then it's leading you down a road that leads to nowhere. So I think working and ensuring you have high quality data, sometimes these national databases, you know, you wonder how clean is this data, or even if it is clean, how reflective of it is it of, you know, in intraoperative, you know, you wonder how accurately this data is being recorded, and, you know, if it's chronologically correct. And so I think promoting high quality data to continue developing these AI innovations, it all comes down to the data. So I think ensuring the roots are good is going to be something that try to promote in the future.
Free of bias and yes, clean data. Very good. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you very much.